Welcome to Indie Media On Air. Today's Indie Media On Air will feature an interview with host Chris Burnett speaking to Avi Lewis, producer of the film The Take. I'm Alice Taylor, and these are some Indie Media headlines. Marla Ruzicka, anti-war activist from California, dies in Iraq. On Saturday, 28-year-old Marla Ruzicka, who is originally from Lakeport, California, was killed when a car bomb exploded on a street in Baghdad. Faiz Ali Salim, her Iraqi partner, was also killed. The attack apparently occurred on the Baghdad Airport Road as they were driving to visit an Iraqi child injured by a bomb. Marla worked for CIVIC, which stands for Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, a humanitarian organization that she founded to document cases of innocent civilians who have been hurt by war. For more on this story, visit indiebay.org. Now, from DC Indie Media, border vigilantes plan to expand camps along southern border. In an effort to pass reactionary immigration law, senators are attempting to attach new immigration restrictions onto the $80 billion supplemental spending bill for the Iraq War. The House already approved the war supplement with immigration provisions that include national standards for driver's licenses, tougher asylum requirements, and authority to waive environmental laws to build a border fence near San Diego. Now from indiemedia.org, fighting for free radio in Mexico City. Radio Zapote, a free radio transmitting from the National School of Anthropology and History in Mexico City, received word from a school official that they were to be evicted in 2 weeks. The news of their possible eviction came just a few weeks after what members of Radio Zapote referred to as a coup d'etat within the National Institute of Anthropology and History. Following the surprising resignation of the democratically elected Sergio Raul Arroyo Garcia, 2 weeks ago, Luciano Cedilla, referred to by a national paper, La Jornada, as the Trojan horse of neoliberalism working against national interests and the essential tasks of the institution, was unilaterally named director of the INAH. Zapote was the only anthropology-based radio station transmitting on the internet from Latin America. Also from indiemedia.org, more than 15,000 in the streets despite state of emergency in Ecuador. Ecuadorian President Lucio Gutierrez declared a state of emergency on Friday after 3 nights of protests against him. The president has suspended civil liberties and fired Supreme Court justices. Protests of over 15,000 workers and middle-class citizens continued in the streets of Quito the next day. Gutierrez revoked the state of emergency and protests continue against him still. La Luna, a radio station in the capital, has been the only medium giving voice to the thousands of citizens who have gathered to expose their rejection of Gutierrez's dictatorship. This movement has united the citizens of Quito and the province of Pichincha to organize marches and create spaces of peaceful resistance. And finally, a story from indiemedia.us, CAFTA in trouble. While anti-CAFTA demonstrations in Guatemala go unheeded by the oligarchy and government, the atmosphere in the U.S. surrounding this flawed trade agreement seemed to have taken a bad turn. As activists take their message to the streets in New York City, Santa Cruz, and elsewhere, the so-called Central American Free Trade Agreement may have a hard road ahead in the U.S. Congress. Recent testimony before the Senate Finance Committee found that many questions were critical and represented for some analysts a growing opposition to the agreement in Congress. Anti-corporate globalization activists, environmentalists, labor unions, and some polls show a majority of U.S. citizens oppose CAFTA. For more on these stories, visit the Indie Media websites.
Welcome to the globalized ghost town. Argentina, it could be anywhere. Abandoned factories, cracked cement, rusting machines. But in the rubble, something's growing. Jobs are coming back.
Actually, jobs are being taken back. The new slogan? Occupy. Resist. Produce.
We are joined now by Avi Lewis, filmmaker from The Take, a documentary about Argentina. Welcome to KPFK, Avi.
It is great to be here.
So I want to dive into the history of the film and what it's about. But first off, let's talk about what the title means. What is The Take?
Well, you know, the film follows this extraordinary new movement of recovered companies, of occupied factories in Argentina. There are some 200 companies, not just factories, there's bakeries and health clinics and schools as well, which have been taken over by their workers and are being run as cooperatives. They've fired the bosses, in effect. And so the original title of the film in Spanish is La Toma, which is the word used for the takeover, the take of the physical place. And so The Take, the title, is really meant to capture this spirit of direct action, of impatience, of people going straight to the heart of solving problems locally and doing it in a very direct fashion, which for listeners of this show should be a fairly familiar theme.
So what happened? I mean, what happened that caused this whole situation to take place? We've talked about Argentina a little bit on Indie Media On Air before, but let's start from, 2001?
The absolute nadir, the low point of the economic crash in Argentina was December, at the end of December 19th and 20th, 2001. And that was the end of a decade of intense neoconservative economic policy, which was imposed on Argentina in the most enthusiastic fashion by a president by the name of Carlos Menem. Carlos Menem makes Schwarzenegger look like a member of a socialist knitting circle. Menem privatized everything. They sold everything, the electricity, the water, the roads, the railroads, the airlines, the phones, in massive corrupt privatizations. They deregulated the economy. He called it surgery without anesthetic. That's what the president of Argentina called what they did there. It was like the International Monetary Fund's wish list for foreign investors. They ripped apart a national economy. They sold it off to their buddies. And they provoked a massive unemployment crisis. And it spiraled into a total economic meltdown. Because when they ran out of things to sell, their GDP growth evaporated. And it turned out that this whole economic system was totally unsustainable and was about destroying the local economy, not about increasing it. So as usual in these cases, the IMF loved what they did. Argentina was the IMF's star pupil throughout the 1990s. And then it started to unravel. And in the end, the system really brought about its own collapse in that when the currency started to shake and it was clear that there was going to be a real economic crisis, the banks, multinational banks and corporations, whisked $40 billion out of the country almost overnight. There were no regulations, financial regulations, left to stop capital flight. And there's a scene in the film which to me is one of the most dramatic images that I found late at night in a local newspaper, a local TV station's archive, of bank trucks driving to the airport in the middle of the night.
I saw that. I was blown away when I was.
That's capital flight, baby. That's what it looks like.
And they were surrounded by police.
Of course.
And they were just, let's get out of here and take the
money. We're getting out.
Just...
So once they sucked the money out of the country, with the cooperation of the local elites and of the government policy, then the bottom fell out of the economic system, and that's when, I mean, people will remember in late 2001 those pictures, dramatic images on our TV screens of Argentines in the streets banging their pots and pans, and they threw out five presidents in 3 weeks. And that was sort of a flash. That's all we sort of saw of the story. Well, what happened there was that the government panicked after all this money had left the country. And they put a banking freeze on so that people couldn't get their money out of the bank accounts. And the power in Argentina made a fundamental miscalculation. They screwed with the upper middle class. They actually locked those privileged and entitled people out of their own life savings. So you had these extraordinary scenes of, you know, soccer moms with Gucci handbags smashing the crap out of bank machines. And, you know, that may be the most revolutionary image of all. Shortly after that, they realized that they'd made a big mistake, and they started giving the richest people back their money through complicated bond swaps over time. But that's when the economy really melted down. What was incredible about what happened in Argentina was, in the wake of that meltdown, people started building a whole range of new social movements and autonomous experiments in the rubble of this failed system. And the recovered companies was just one, but there were many different social movements that emerged.
I want to remind listeners that the Take is playing now through Thursday at the Lemley Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills. That's 9036 Wilshire Boulevard. It's also playing at Lemley 1 Colorado in Pasadena at 42 Miller Alley. Let's talk about some of the worker factories and what they actually had to do. What does it mean when they take over the factories? I know in the film there's this sort of back and forth with the government, mm-hmm. with one of the particular factories, but there were others where there was direct action. They came in and they occupied, and the slogan is "Occupy, Resist, Produce."
Yeah, and it's the produce at the end of it that really is a challenge to traditional labor action throughout this century, where withholding your labor when they're trying to close down your place of work is exactly what they want you to do. So it's the idea of insisting on working, which is really a genuine challenge, not just to power and the system, but to traditional labor unions and the whole idea of labor action. All of these factories and other businesses, and there are about 200 in Argentina, that have sustained and grown in the last 3 years since this phenomenon started, 3 or 4 years now, they were companies in the process of bankruptcy. Because of the disastrous economic policy, thousands of businesses were closing. And in every bankruptcy, workers are a creditor because they always slash your wages. They always fail to contribute to your pension plan and your health plan. So workers are always creditors in a bankruptcy. The funny thing is they just never get paid because the secured creditors, the top of the list is always the banks. Once the banks have sold off all the machines, there's nothing left for the people who worked there for 30 years. So what the workers in Argentina were doing was making a very sophisticated legal and political argument, which was, not only if you count up all of our unpaid wages and our status as major creditors in the bankruptcy, but if you look at all of the corporate welfare, all of the public money, all of the tax holidays and the subsidized utilities, not to mention just the gifts from governments to their factory owning buddies, we have already put more public money into these workplaces than private. And this workplace should belong to the community, and it should stay open and be run by the community collectively in the community's local economic interest. Now, this is a very familiar scenario in America, except for the part where they go and they occupy the plant and they put it back to work. And that's what they did in Argentina. But it's a very pragmatic movement because it's not a movement which is being driven by ideology. And I think this is also something that's really intriguing for activists all over the world. It's not like, as we were talking before we went on air about the Spanish Civil War, they didn't have 30 years of developing radical consensus and democratic techniques to use when they got their chance. These are middle-class workers, or working-class people who were in industrial jobs, so they were able to feed their families and send their kids to university, who all of a sudden see collective action and direct action as the only possible way to get back the dignity of earning a living. So they don't come with a prefix ideology which they're imposing in the situation. The theory is running to catch up with the action. So it's really a movement in flux. A lot of people, there are great anti-capitalist movements that are joining this struggle. They're getting support and also threats of co-optation from all kinds of other political factions.
Like what kinds of co-optation?
Well, the usual ones. There's sectarian left parties in Argentina, lots of them, who see power being built in the working class, and they're very interested in co-opting that. So there's a few left-wing parties, Trotskyist parties and Marxist-Leninist parties and other parties of the old left, who actually have their own occupied factories. But if you look carefully, there's no production going on because no one who's occupying the factory actually ever worked there. But every party now in Argentina, that it's a new phenomenon, they all want to have their own occupied factory.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. And then there's also, the legacy of Peronism is a huge, it is the living culture of Argentine politics. It's the dominant political party and a very complicated movement that spans far right death squads, really, which were funded by Perón in the 70s, to the biggest armed guerrilla left-wing movement, the Montoneros, in Latin America at that time. And the legacy of that huge political tent which is still the ruling party of Argentina. So there are lots of factions of Peronist parties who are also trying to co-opt this movement. And but in the actual workplaces, what you normally find is a few really politicized, more activist members and a large group of people who just want to get their jobs back. And what you see in the film and what was really moving for me as an activist to spend 8 months in a context which was totally foreign to me was to see people be politicized by struggle, not to come to struggle with their ideology, but to find through need that they started to understand that solidarity was the only way to get back their middle class lifestyle.
And I think that came through very well in the scene where the worker is going to meet with the other workers to get help, and he breaks down crying, and it was, you know, he was at a loss. They'd been struggling for a long time. And the only way out of it, or the only way forward, was to work with these other people who had this experience.
And you see, and really, the central figure in the film is this guy, Freddy Espinoza. He's a tool and die maker. He's a fairly reluctant hero because he's the president of his cooperative in an auto parts factory. But he really isn't a progressive or a lefty to start with. He really is finding politics through a very pragmatic struggle. And you see him go early in the film when he goes to that meeting that you just described. When he goes into that meeting, he meets with one of the leaders of the movements, one of the pioneers of the movement. And he says, you know, I'm really worried about this. Here, we're 30 guys. We're really fighting to get back our plant. But if we win, all these other people are going to come in and say, I want to be part of the cooperative. I want my job now. That's not fair. And he's got a very individualistic view of struggle. By later in the film, when they go to visit another recovered company, a tractor factory, which is going to order parts from them and help them to develop their economic plan, he says at the end of that scene, if we get working again and we actually get producing and anyone else in this movement needs help, I'll be the first to go and help them. You can count on that. And you start to see how he is making the fundamental movement of the soul, the actual motion from seeing his struggle as a private issue to seeing how his fate is connected to the fates of all the other people who are struggling. And I think that's – now we're getting down to the really basic stuff. And documentary film is an amazing medium in which you can show those personal transformations.
I'm speaking with Avi Lewis, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara and on the web at kpfk.org. This is Indie Media On Air, and we are talking about a new documentary that's playing right now through Thursday at the Lemley Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills called The Take. It's a documentary about Argentina. It's at 9036 Wilshire Boulevard, also at the Lemley one, Colorado and Pasadena. Continuing our discussion, one thing that we talked about briefly before the show was the state of the factories today. How are they? How are they doing?
You know, one of the reasons that we chose to focus on this particular social movement in Argentina rather than the Picatero movement, which was the real mass movement, much larger and in some ways, many ways more significant movement, the unions of the unemployed that started up in the early 90s with the layoffs and privatizations, or the neighborhood assembly movement, which was kind of a downtown middle class movement of people meeting on street corners and reclaiming direct democracy in their neighborhoods, or the trueques, where the barter clubs that started up, where people started creating their own currency and operating, you know, completely outside the capitalist market. We chose this one because it struck us that it was probably the most sustainable as a really concrete alternative to corporate capitalism that had the chance to really build jobs for people in communities that where unemployment was the number one problem. And that has turned out to be true so far. I don't want to romanticize it. We're talking about 15,000 workers in a country of 30 million people. It's a drop in the bucket in terms of a national economy, but it's an extraordinarily powerful example of how you can create, how you can run businesses and have jobs in totally horizontal terms with horizontal structures where there's real democracy in the workplace and a totally different set of values that rules over people's working lives. And that has actually proven, ironically, very profitable. Because when you get rid of corrupt CEOs and overblown salaries and stupid management decisions and that whole layer of people in a company that do bugger all but interfere with the work being done, and you recognize that the people who do the work are actually perfectly capable of managing it. In fact, the best at the best at managing it, it's actually really easy to make a profit. And what the recovered companies do with their profit is they hire more workers.
So don't they have a higher wage too?
Well, you know, you're dealing with a movement that came up in right after a massive currency devaluation and one of the biggest economic meltdowns in modern history, where half the population descended below the poverty line in a very few years in what was formerly a middle-class country, Argentina. So what I can say is that 3 or 4 years into this movement, they aren't taking over lots of new factories. The number is steady at around 200. But within those factories, they have been raising the salaries regularly to the point where now the vast majority of them are making, in comparable terms, what they were making before the crash, which is an extraordinary advance. And you take the Zanon tile factory, the largest ceramic tile factory in Latin America, which makes it the largest occupied factory in the world. When we finished filming a little more than a year ago, they had 300 employees. They have 450 employees today. That's an increase of 50% in their workforce in 1 year. That's a staggering increase in jobs in a time when corporations actually never boast about adding jobs. They only boast about cutting jobs. So the movement is growing and the conditions are growing. But actually that brings them to a really incredible time. Now's the moment of truth in a way, because you think about this. You have a group of people, 100 or a couple of hundred people, or in some workplaces smaller, 15 or 20 people, who have fought for years. They fought so hard. They faced police repression. They've built support in the community. They've figured out how to run their businesses again. And now they're paying themselves enough to feed their families, and they've got surplus. So then they have a meeting and they say, what do we do with the extra money? We could pay ourselves more and buy new consumer goods, or we could hire more people and bring the unemployed community around us into the circle of hope. And so it's kind of truth time. And the beautiful thing about this movement is they're going to debate and they're going to decide democratically. And some of them are going to decide to pay themselves more and make what we might consider to be heartbreaking and selfish decisions. And some of them are going to see the value of solidarity and that the project is fundamentally about expanding the circle. But they're going to do it democratically and they're going to decide themselves.
Now, the state has come down with some serious repression. And it's bringing back memories of the dictatorship era days. Let's talk about that. What happened recently with a woman who was kidnapped in a falcon, which was a symbol of the repressive regime?
Well, there you go. I mean, the Zanon workers in Patagonia, in the state of Neuquén, are facing a very hostile far right wing provincial government. And recently, the new security minister, in a ceremony where he was appointing a whole basketball auditorium full of new police officers, started railing against Zanon workers and calling them delinquents, which is a word that really recalls the dictatorship era. Those were the undesirables that the military disappeared among the 30,000 people who were tortured and murdered in that psycho-dictatorship from 76 to 83. Shortly after that, the wife of one of the Zanon workers was kidnapped in a Ford Falcon, that car which symbolizes the dictatorship, as you said. She was tortured and beaten brutally and said, this is a message for the workers. They told her when her husband goes to work in the morning, what time her kids get home from school. Again, the intelligence culture of authoritarianism. And they came back to her home a few days later, right after her family had left, and beat her again. There were death threats left on the answering machine of the factory, and they traced them back to an office in the provincial government. So these are unreconstructed fascists from the military period who were never punished in Argentina, because the so-called transition to democracy that happened in 1983, the requirement that the military had was that they have impunity, and these people were never punished. And they're still operating in Argentina in these thinly veiled mafias. So the Zanon factory is getting so powerful and so successful that it's starting to bring back these really ugly things. But in a way, that's a measure of their success as well. And the international support for Zanon has been extraordinary.
This is Indie Media On Air, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with our discussion with Avi Lewis, The Take and Argentina.
Si viene el estallido de mi guitarra, de tu gobierno,
sonido de mi guitarra, de tu movimiento. Dame serenata chido.
All right, we are back. This is Indie Media on Air, and we are talking with Avi Lewis, filmmaker of The Take. The Take is the name of a documentary by Canadian husband and wife team Avi Lewis and Naomi Klein. It focuses on the worker takeovers of factories in Argentina in the wake of one of the worst economic collapses in recent times. Avi, who was that?
That's one of the great rock national rock bands of Argentina called Bersuit Vergarabat, and the song is called Se Viene. The lyrics are, here comes the explosion of my guitarra and your government as well. So it's kind of like, they're a bit of a macho wanker rock band, but they have really bad gender politics and really good class politics. So they play a role in supporting the movement. And they actually, in our film, there's a concert scene that they give for the workers of the Zenon ceramic tile factory. And it's really important for the Zenon workers to get the support of a big mainstream rock
band. Let's talk
about
that. Go on.
Well, I mean, you know, these struggles, like the struggle of the South Central farmers here in LA. I mean, here's the spirit of Occupy, Resist, Produce, of The Take, right here in your backyard. You've got 350 Latino families who are collectively farming land in this city, which is unused land. It's the same model in many ways as the MST in Brazil, the huge landless people's movement in Brazil, the biggest social movement in Latin America. And you've got these same principles of, if we are not going to have decent jobs, if we're going to be marginalized in communities, and there's arable land sitting right next to us that is owned publicly, we're going to take it and use it.
Yeah, and that's at 41st and Alameda here in Los Angeles, South Central Farmers.
So the South Central Farmers, who had this event yesterday with lots of local bands supporting them and are getting endorsements, and we're trying to raise awareness of the South Central Farmers through the release of The Take. You know, these cultural supports for local political struggles are really important. They work on a lot of levels. They give the people who are doing the shitty, hard daily work of struggling a morale boost, which is really cool. They open spaces in other parts of the culture to talk about the political themes, direct action and direct democracy and other things that don't usually get associated with or don't always get associated with documentaries opening in theaters or big rock bands. And they also reach large and wide middle class audiences around the world, which we've I don't know if our audience has been large, but it's been pretty middle class. And we have managed to reach a lot of people with the struggle of Zenon. So, for instance, when Zenon was facing its last eviction threat and then these terrible kidnappings and other intimidation measures, we started a petition in support of the workers of Zenon, calling on the government, the national government, to intervene and give the workers the permanent right to be free from the threat of eviction and run the factory themselves. We got more than 20,000 signatures in a matter of a couple of weeks from 75 different countries by hitting the email networks and just riding on the word of mouth that was out there in activist communities about the film. Yesterday in Buenos Aires, there was a new brand of running shoe launched by a worker-controlled factory. I'm actually wearing a pair of knockoff Converse that were made out of worker control. They're pretty sweet. But the workers at Kook, this running shoe collective, have taken back their factory from bankruptcy. They've got it back in operation. There's 250 people working in assemblies, direct democracy, to make all the decisions of production. And working with some of our film crew and some other people who got involved, they've launched their own brand of running shoe, which they launched yesterday in Buenos Aires at a worker-controlled hotel in downtown Buenos Aires. And it happened partly because a young guy, a New Yorker who saw the film last September at Film Forum in New York, got really excited and had studied cooperative economics in university but had been working on Wall Street and wanted to do something, had always wanted to do something in cooperative economics. He saw our film, got inspired to try to help out, and came up with the idea of starting a community capital fund where he would raise the money here in the States, and he's raised almost $100,000. And it's created a capital fund for use in the recovered companies that gets borrowed by the different companies. All the workers vote on the conditions of the loan. And as they pay it back, it goes back out to other recovered companies to buy raw materials, to design a new logo, to launch a marketing campaign and sell their products. And this NGO called The Working World, which you can find at thetake.org, our film website, or at theworkingworld.org, O-R-G, has started up, and they've already made loans to three different recovered companies, and they're playing
all in Argentina.
All in this movement that's documented in the film in Argentina. Although the idea, if we can make it successful in Argentina, is for it to migrate. Basically, it's applying the principles of microloans, which have been used in Bangladesh and other parts of Asia for 30 years now, to industrial workplaces for we, as far as we can tell, for the first time. And it, you know, in terms of the power of activist media, it was one person who saw the film in a theater who started this, what is now a collective process, which has led to really concrete solidarity and even generating capital for these worker-run businesses, which I find really humbling and staggering.
It's amazing. One of the things for me that Argentina represents is really a smashing of the myth that capitalists need to run the business. You know, it completely – I mean, that's what's so important about this story. It completely undermines, you know, the idea that we have to submit ourselves to, you know, authoritarian top-down structures and live in a world where, you know, we don't have any dignity.
Well, not only that, we spend most – if we work, most of our lives – is spent in a place where we have no human rights. We don't have the right of freedom of speech or freedom of assembly. When was the last time you tried speaking your mind at work? We don't have fundamental human rights in our workplace.
Private, unaccountable tyrannies.
Yeah. There are little circles of authoritarianism in which we live our lives. And this culture is very deeply rooted in us.
And it's sad to say that it's often replicated on the left.
Sure,
it is. In a lot of organizations, too.
Well, there's no question about that. And I think one of the really moving things for me in the film is seeing people trying to root out the hierarchies within and trying to reinvent themselves in a circle where they're facing each other, trying to make decisions together in the very same place where they've been working side by side for 30 years under a hierarchical system. All of a sudden, they're trying to reinvent themselves in the very place where they have been under the boss's thumb for all their working lives. And it's a real struggle. It's not easy. And it's Lalo, one of the characters in the film, one of the more politicized organizers in the film, wrote me an email a few months ago when I asked him how it was going. And he said, you know how hard it is to recover a business because you were with us for 8 months while we recovered that business. It's so much harder to recover a worker. And that's the real struggle. These struggles are internal struggles.
Consciousness,
yeah,
shifting, I was saying before, I often do consensus trainings, and a long time ago, 10 or 15 years ago, when I first went through the process, somebody said to me, "You know, you're soaking wet right now. You're outside, and I come in. You're coming into this place, and it's drying here, but you're going to be wet for a very long time."
And that's, you know, that's the thing. It's a challenge for everyone working in progressive movements. That we're, you know, we have to challenge ourselves all the time. And it's pretty humbling to see what's happening in Argentina, because it was a very consumer society. They embraced intense individualism in the 1990s. The whole country went on a shopping spree when they pegged their currency to the U.S. dollar and they had an inflated currency. And so it's a particularly poignant place to see people really trying to challenge that culture in themselves.
Let's talk about the international response.
Well, the Zenon workers in particular have provided a lightning rod.
I mean, we had the one example from the raising capital through the community.
Well, yeah, but I mean, really what you're getting is activist movements, particularly in Europe right now, who are sending delegations to the recovered companies in Argentina, and also realizing when they get down there that this is just one part of a very complex and diverse series of social movements. Many of which are doing things which are politically much more advanced. I think really looking at horizontal structures, you see it in a nascent way in the occupied factories, and you can see them struggling with it. But if you go into some of the more autonomous Picotero movements, these are movements that are semi-rural on the borderlines between the rust belts and the rural territory. Really, like, it's the place where the roads break right down into paths. And in those communities, which is where the majority of the population around Buenos Aires lives, there are these massive unions of the unemployed, Picotero groups. Some of them, small ones, practice, it's like a consensus decision-making wet dream. They really have purely horizontal movements. They're doing micro-enterprises. They're baking bread and building bricks and publishing books and starting libraries in a purely horizontal construct where there has to be total consensus before anyone does anything, and they work. I would say there are kind of a vision of purity in political terms. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I mean that in a really inspiring way. And there's lots of things going on in Argentina which are like that outside of the movement that we document in the film.
I'm speaking with Avi Lewis, filmmaker of The Take. And you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara and kpfk.org. This is Indie Media On Air, and this has been a great discussion having – you know, diving into sort of the politics and history of what happened and is happening in Argentina. One thing strikes me is what were the roots, you know, what allowed this kind of thing to happen? You know, certainly it was clearly out of need, after the economic collapse. But one thing that, you know, about the Spanish Civil War, and I've read a lot about the Spanish Civil War, is that they had these cultural institutions, very close ties, ways of working together, community-based, practices. And my understanding is that's also the case in Argentina.
Yeah, it's funny. You're getting to one of the – this is the real core question.
And it's something that's actually – it's necessitated.
Yeah.
Or the movement needs that kind of – that history, that cultural history. And I often ask myself, is that even possible in the United States? Do we even have that culture? And I mean, no.
Well, that's
some places we do, but we're struggling with the excessive, extreme individualism.
That's it.
And selfishness and greed, and you know, it's
that's a huge part of it. I mean, the whenever I do Q&As after film screenings, someone will always say, "That's really cool, what's going on in Argentina, but could it ever happen here?" Didn't it happen in Argentina because the crisis was – I mean, do things have to get that bad before people will get off their asses, get off the couch, and do something about it? And on one level, it's true. The economic crash in Argentina was dramatic. It was fast. It was a whole country descending into poverty that was previously middle class. But if you want to talk about the economic crisis, it's already here for tens of millions of Americans. The poverty and the hopelessness and the total social and economic exclusion is already here in huge parts of this country, but we're not seeing the same thing. So just the economic crisis alone isn't enough. You're right. There already were cultural fabrics and mechanisms that people and revolutionary traditions that people were able to put back into force. But I'm a little bit impatient with the Latin envy that we inevitably have in North America when we look at Latin social movements, which are so big and so powerful. They're so rooted. They're really broad and deep. They have huge community support. And it's understandable to feel sort of activist inferiority complex about that. But at the same time, we have to be challenged to see what we can learn from these movements and how we can apply it and lever change here. What, you know, I learned some very specific things from watching these social movements in Argentina that I've been discussing with fellow Canadian activists about tactics and strategies, about building community support, about before you do a housing occupation, spending 6 months in that neighborhood, going door to door and talking to neighbors so that when you take over a building and turn it into affordable housing and the cops come and pepper spray you and take you out, there's 200 or 500 or 1,000 middle-class non-activists who you've built alliances with over the past 6 months to actually stand with you. That's something that you see the Zenon workers doing. Every worker in that factory has an 8-hour shift every work where their paid job is political education, where they stand on a street corner, they hand out leaflets, they go door to door, and they explain to their neighbors what they're doing. They talk to people who don't agree with them, which could be the most radical thing you can do.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the comment about the activist inferiority complex, it's true, but there's also, you know, a lot of us who are conscious of not feeling that way. I was watching a video of Ward Churchill talking, and I've heard Chomsky say this a number of times, but one of the questions that he was asked, Churchill, was, you know, how am I an ordinary American? What can I do? I feel so disempowered. Mm-hmm. And his response was, why is it that a Guatemalan peasant, when, you know, doesn't ask these questions? You know, what is it about Americans that they feel so disempowered? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's a lot to say about that, but certainly, yeah. Certainly this, it's, you know, we are in probably one of the most expensive propaganda systems in the world. It spends billions of dollars convincing us of our powerlessness.
Yeah, and the divide and conquer techniques of empire are most sophisticated here and applied in I think in some of the deepest cultural ways in this country. And in that way, the very first movement is the movement of the heart, to see that our fates are intertwined, and to actually see your own life as connected to somebody else's is the very first, to not feel crazy anymore, to not feel alone, may be the first step towards something where we can have those collective traditions and those community mechanisms that we can rely on to fuel those opportunities, those moments when we can really make social progress.
When you are talking after these films, and you say one of the most common questions is, you know, can it happen here? What was your response?
Well, one of my responses is to say, look for the spirit of the take, for the new impatience, for the spirit of direct action and direct democracy in your community, and make the connections. The South Central farmers are embodying the spirit of the take. They're taking over unused assets, and they're making them productive, and they're organizing democratically for the good of the local community, where the system has absolutely excluded and failed them. That is the same spirit, and it's happening in your backyard. Look at Chatsworth Products. Here is a company that makes metal frames for computers in data storage facilities, which was bought by a huge multinational in the 1980s. The multinational sold it wanted to sell it 3 years later, just ditch it, and they couldn't find a buyer, so they were just going to close it down. It was a profitable company. 600 Latino and Asian workers put together an employee share ownership program, took over management of the factory. It's been 20 years that factory has been run more or less democratically and under worker ownership. There are 10 million Americans who work in ESOPs, in some form of employee share ownership program. The vast majority of those have no democracy in the workplace, and many of those workers don't even know that they in some way own their companies. But that is a site of resistance and of real opportunity right there in America. If those workplaces could be targeted for bringing real democracy into the workplace, there's where we could do it here. So for me, the process of making the film is all about making the connections and identifying those sites of constructive resistance and places where we can build genuine alternatives here in the heart of the beast. And I think there are tons of them.
I'm speaking with Abby Lewis, filmmaker of The Take. And you did this with your wife, Naomi Klein. And it's playing, I should remind listeners, it's playing now through Thursday at Lemley Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills at 9036 Wilshire Boulevard. It's also at the Lemley 1 Colorado in Pasadena at 42 Miller Alley. Where are people talking about doing this type of model? You say there's a lot of delegates from Europe coming to Argentina and probably from all over the world, I'm guessing. What are their goals for coming there? What are they trying to do? Are they trying to bring back this model? Are they trying to, well, you know, not just end support it?
You know, I think the response to a one-size-fits-all economic model is clearly not to put up our own one-size-fits-all model and say occupied factories are the only alternative to corporate globalization. We should therefore do them everywhere. It's all about, as you and your listeners know so well, adapting these principles of constructive resistance to our local conditions. And activists around the world who have been really interested in Argentina in the last few years have been doing that. One example, we launched the film in France and Italy last month, and there's a group called the Followers of San Precario, a group of activists in Milan, and they have a really strong link with a group in Barcelona, who have created a patron saint of precarious workers. And they've made, there's a Canadian artist whose name eludes me at the moment, who does these fabulous portraits of fast food workers in prayer with celestial light on their faces. Robin, I'm going to remember it as soon as we're off the air. And there's a few in No Logo. And they've constructed a life-size saint of a fast food worker, a McDonald's worker in prayer, and they've named him San Precario. And they take him around to symbolize the connections between all precarious workers in the global economy, migrants and refugees whose experience in other fields are excluded and they're reduced to selling bootleg CDs on the street, young people who work in the service sector, in malls, for big box retailers. Self-employed media workers, musicians, and independent media makers and contractors who have no steady work, as well as unemployed industrial workers, sex workers. The experience of work in this global economic period is the experience of precariousness. And they've invented a patron saint, which is cheeky and lovely in a Catholic country. And they're making the connections between these different struggles and building whole new alliances, a whole new idea of a workers' movement that is based on our common experience of work in this time. And that's a really creative and, I think, incredible lens through which to see the connections. And they've really embraced the film that they're showing in social centers in Italy, a sort of sponsored by San Precario, brought to you by San Precario. And I think that's a really important way in which they are incorporating the Argentine experience and making connections to African street vendors in their own town and trying to see how the struggles really are won.
There was some photos I saw. I got to see of a friend of mine who went down into these occupied factories. And one of the things that really, really touched me was the artistic connections between the workers and the spaces that they used. And they opened them up to the communities and musicians and artists came in and there was – it wasn't a one-way exchange but mm-hmm. a two-way exchange.
Really, really cool on the student front too. A lot of political movements of the past have had students in the role of a vanguard where, if you look at the 60s and the 68 in Europe and a lot of that old school model of how revolution happens, the enlightened middle class students, learn about revolutionary history. They go and teach the workers. In Argentina these days, the students are going to the factories and saying, how can we help? We're learning about I'm studying business. I could help you guys make a marketing plan. We could get you a nice logo or we do video. We're going to do a commercial for your ceramic tiles. Or we could, there are sociology and psychology students who are starting to do counseling in the recovered companies, medical students who are starting to set up health clinics in the occupied factories, and a whole, coming with humility to say, how can we support and help your struggle rather than how can we get you to really see the light and do this revolution the way we say? And that's a really – artists, as usual, are at the forefront of that.
Yeah. I mean, and that actually that distinction between those approaches is a very, giant political rift,
yeah.
from, on the left.
And it always has been. And that – we're not going to solve that here today or ever.
Yeah.
But it is really interesting to see – and in Argentina, because it's a very, very complex political culture – a lot of things are possible that might be more difficult in other places. The Zenon factory, which we've talked about a lot today, many of the leaders within the company are self-acknowledged members of a Trotskyist party. And when I first found that out, I was like, whoa, really? So is this sort of a front for a kind of a different political project, or is it really horizontal? And I asked Raul Godoy, who is the kind of the leader of the struggle, point blank in an interview. So I've heard a lot of people say that you're just an old school trot. Like, what's up here? Is this really something new or not? And he said, guilty as charged. That's what I have a fairly dogmatic, and he used that word, political belief. But I believe in democracy more than I believe in my ideology. And I win some arguments and I lose some. But ultimately, we vote. And I make my case the best that I can. And I accept the will of the workers. He was very impressive on how his personal ideology had been challenged, but how fundamentally he believed in democracy. Yeah. And that was more important than his version of how revolution should happen. And that's really inspiring, because then we could harness all of the organizing energy.
Is that unusual?
It is pretty unusual. It's unusual anywhere in the world. I've seen it happen a few times in Argentina. Maybe the most exciting development in terms of left politics, because if we could all organize together and respect the actual – some kind of democratic process, then we could harness our collective organizing energy and we would be much, much, much more powerful. But that's not happening in most of the left in the world or in history. But the possibility of it is very inspiring.
Well, I mean, the model is anti-authoritarian.
Right. And if you really embrace democracy as the response to authoritarianism, then it creates all kinds of openings.
Abby, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Indie Media On Air. It's been a pleasure having you.
I love this show. It's been great to talk to you today.
The Take is playing in Beverly Hills at the Limley Music Hall 3, 9036 Wilshire, and in Pasadena at Limley 1, Colorado, 42 Miller Alley. All right, this is Indie Media On Air. I'm your host, Chris Burnett, and I want to thank Alan Minsky, who produced the show today, and our engineer, Maggie LaPeak. We'll be back next week. I wanted to take a minute to say a few words for my friend Scott Gottlieb, who passed away last week after a year-long battle with leukemia. I've known Scott for 20 years. He was an amazing human being whose determination and focus in life will be a source of strength for all his friends and family. He was one of those kids that no matter what was going on in our lives, he can manage to put a smile on your face. As a musician, Scott was equally determined. During the last month of his life, he chose to remove himself from bed to record the drum tracks on his band's latest record, even when his illness seemed overwhelming. Scott and all of our friends growing up were deeply affected by music and its power to shift people's consciousness. So it wasn't surprising that we were attracted to the kind of music that made people think about the world. Scott always embraced challenging ideas, but always managed to find the time to laugh about bad ones. I know Scott is going to be missed greatly by his friends and family. I know I am going to miss him, and in fact, haven't been able to stop thinking about him. And I am fortunate to have his music to remember him by. I wanted to play a song called Broken Wings that was written for Scott by his band Bleed the Dream. Take care of yourself, Scott, wherever you may be. You will never be out of our thoughts, my friend, and you will live with us until we meet again.
Songs of fear and loss, and they cut me down to size, and they cut me down to size. Just pass us by.